Hey, y'all. Welcome to this episode of Foamcast. I'm Lauren Westifer, and with me today, we have Jeremy Faust.
Hey, it's Jeremy. I've heard great things about this podcast. I'm excited to be a guest. And, you know, I think I'm still a host, kind of. Thanks for keeping me around. So let's hop right into it. Emergency medicine. I love it. It's something I still practice. We're going to do this episode on intramuscular chemical sedation, going through some of the agents, upsides and downsides. And there is new literature on this. And quite frankly, it's practice changing depending on what you're doing now.
Yeah. And agitation, it's common in the emergency department. And it's sort of a spectrum. There are a lot of different things that can cause agitation, whether it's medical, somebody has a bleed in their brain, it can cause them to be agitated, not understand why we need to get things done. People can be agitated when they're older and have dementia or some delirium. People can be agitated because they're under the influence of some sort of substances. We see those all the time. And it's really common. There was a recent study by Shenvi et al. That found that at U.S. Academic Emergency Department that physical assault was reported by 34% of all respondents and 22% of residents. And nearly 1 in 10, so 9%, reported multiple physical assaults.
A lot of ways of dealing with this, always starting with verbal de-escalation. The offer of the sandwich can help. Of course, if that doesn't work, then you're moving on to other things, the chemical restraint, medications, and physical restraint being the thing that you don't want to do because there are so many bad things around that. But we do try to go in sort of a stepwise fashion, starting with that calm. Let me talk to you. Let me see if this person is willing to engage or if I can meet them where they are. At the last resort, you have your chemical and physical options.
Right. And I don't think any of us want to go there. It's sort of one of those last resorts thing, but we encounter this so often because people put us in jeopardy. We risk our safety, but also the safety of the department. You got to watch out for the other patients and make sure that everyone is being safe, including that patient. So sometimes it's for their own safety. And what's interesting is we all sort of have a cocktail that we go to. It's sort of like the migraine cocktails. And what's interesting is we tend to use what we were trained on or what we grew up on. Now, Jeremy, what do you tend to go to in these situations?
Yeah, besides my lovely affect, I try to use really what's common at the two hospitals where I work at. And it's so cultural. So at one place, we do not have droperidol. So I don't use droperidol there, at least not as often. I think we're getting it now. So at my one hospital, I tend to use 5-haldol and 2-lorazepam usually. Sometimes 5-2-1, adding the bends. But, you know, I think that the thing is that when I think about it, I've moved towards droperidol at my other shop, and it works great, but not as well maybe as the literature told me it would. I felt like when we got droperidol, it was like, oh, this is going to solve all my problems. And part of me wonders if, like, the kinds of medications, the kinds of substances people are using today are just a little more powerful than they were 20 years ago when droperidol was last uses monotherapy. And so it's like, it's not your grandfather's stimulant that is driving this patient to like try to attack us. It's something much stronger. So I find droperidol is great as monotherapy, but it's not as much a silver bullet as I was hoping it would be when we got it in our hospital.
I'm kind of similar. So I've worked at the same institution for my whole quote unquote life as an emergency medicine resident, fellow, and attending. And what I grew up on was 5 of haloperidol and 2 of lorazepam. But what's interesting is I have come to change that practice. So we got droperidol, we got ketamine, and then I realized that, you know, droperidol didn't just solve all my problems, and that often I pair it with a benzodiazepine. My go-to was lorazepam, but when I really read the literature, I was like, I'm doing something wrong. And so that's what we're going to focus on today is sort of what does the literature say about some of these things? So thinking about our priorities, Jeremy, what are our priorities in terms of selecting a medication for patients?
Well, right now we're talking about a patient who might not have IV access or who does not have IV access. So you're looking for something that can be administered intramuscularly and speedily. So speed of onset and also safe, rapid effect if you can get it, and nothing dangerous so that you are sitting there like trying to intubate your patient 5 minutes later. No, you haven't accomplished very much.
And just remember, we're talking about like the very agitated patient. Verbal de-escalation doesn't work. They're not going to take a medication to sort of help them calm down orally. So unfortunately, you got to go this route. And we're going to focus on ketamine here because it's an interesting thing. There was a recent randomized controlled trial by Barbic et al. In Annals of Emergency Medicine. And number two, we're going to focus on midazolam versus lorazepam to add to that antipsychotic to the haloperidol or droperidol? Does it matter which one? Are there advantages to different ones? And so we do have to dive a little bit here into some pharmacology. We're going to talk a little bit about medication, the onset time, and the duration. So Jeremy, how quickly does ketamine tend to work, the studies say?
IM ketamine will work within 3 to 7 minutes, supposedly, and will last about a half an hour. One thing about ketamine for IM, you've got to have the right concentration, because if you don't have the right concentration, you'll be giving essentially a liter into someone's arm. That's not going to work. So you have to make sure that you have the different concentration. Otherwise, there's just not a thigh or a gluteus muscle in the world that can take it all. Then there's droperidol. Onset time, 5-10 minutes. Again, I find maybe towards 10 plus in real life and lasts longer, 2 to 4 hours.
And then we have the benzos like midazolam. The onset is 10 to 15 minutes. It lasts like 1 to 2 hours. And here we're talking typical doses are like 5 milligrams intramuscularly, maybe 2 to 5 if it's paired with something, or if you use it alone, it's often 10 to 15 milligrams. Lorazepam takes a bit longer to kick in. So there you're looking more at the 15 plus minute, lasts about 6 hours. And then we've got olanzapine, 15 to 30 minutes for the onset. So that takes a little bit longer. Jeremy, where does Haldol stack in there? So droperidol, its cousin, is like 5 to 10 minutes. What about Haldol?
Yeah, much slower, 20 minutes, 30 minutes, up to 60 minutes to really work. And remember, folks, this is IM. IV, different story altogether. You could get almost an immediate effect for some of these, although Haldol, not immediately. But something like a midaz, which will take 10 to 15 minutes, just trying to repeat that for you, still does work extremely quickly if you have intravenous access. But IM, we're looking at much longer times. So that's why, for example, if you have a patient who's agitated and psychiatry is saying, oh, why don't you give them some olanzapine or Haldol IM? The answer is because I can't wait around for 20, 30 minutes while it works.
Yeah. And it's not an inpatient thing. Like, this is a safety thing, is that,
right,
you know, you've got these patients and you've got a department and there are ways that they could hurt themselves, ways they could hurt other people, or maybe they've already gone through some of that. And so the 15 minute onset just isn't always enough, which is why we've often paired things like the Haldol with the lorazepam, trying to get it to work a little bit more quickly. All right. So that's just a quick overview of those. Ketamine worked the quickest in just a couple minutes, and then sort of the droperidol and midazolam, followed by things like Haldol, olanzapine a little bit later. Now, let's talk about ketamine first, because that's where a lot of the excitement is. And I mentioned that we're going to cover a trial by Barbic et al. Jeremy, tell me a little bit about this trial.
Really interesting. This is a trial that actually enrolled patients to either get ketamine or midazolam, haloperidol. And basically the idea is looking for time to sedation to see if things were really just controlled more quickly.
Yeah, and they enrolled 80 patients. They were hoping for more, but what happened was COVID, which we understand. And they enrolled 80 patients and 40 in each group. And then they somehow lost one in the ketamine arm to follow up. What they found here was that patients in the ketamine arm, and here it was 5 milligrams per kilogram, they got sedated much more quickly, average of 5.8 minutes compared to almost 15 minutes for the midazolam haloperidol arm. Here they found a difference of 8.8 minutes, which I think is a lot of time. That's an eternity when you've really got somebody who's violent in front of you. And so they found ketamine worked about 9 minutes quicker.
Well, a couple of things here. First of all, I couldn't ignore that difference in minutes is so important, both for the safety of the patient, and also there's this urge to give a rescue agent. And so I think that when it's been 8, 10, 12 minutes, you start thinking, is it working? Should I get something else? And now you're subjecting a patient to medications they may not need, because that rapid onset, it sort of treats your brain. You're like, oh, it's working. Okay, great. I don't have to redose this person. Another thing I wanted to point out in this trial, and Lauren, I wanted to know what you think, is the dosing on the ketamine. 5 milligrams per kilogram IM, that ain't messing around. 5 mg per kg IM is more than I've been giving. And I wonder if that's because I'm weak sauce. What have you been doing?
I think it's within the range. So 3 is the lowest that I will go. And typically that I go with 4. It's right in the middle, because I don't want to have to give more. I don't want to subject them to that. And I need rapid control, because bad things can happen. So I'll typically go around 4. I think that in this study, one thing that we got to realize is they didn't just give the ketamine in the thigh and then walk away. They were in cardiac monitored beds. and they were hooked up to the monitor and all those things. And those things are really important because I think sometimes the temptation is, you know, get the medication in, kind of leave them be, which is good. But also we have a certain area of our emergency department dedicated to handle these decompensated patients right when they come in the door. And we have had to take out a lot of the stuff from the rooms because people will try to hurt themselves or hurt other people. You know, it doesn't take much for something to become a projectile. Putting these people on the monitor isn't the first thing that we do. Sometimes it takes a little bit of time once you have to get adequately sedated and all that. So I think they went higher here and they were able to do that. And they had a protocol to try to be safe. But did bad things happen to any of these people?
Well, I just wanted to point out that in the other trials of ketamine, you don't really always see a dose this high, right? So in the Riddell trial, I think the average person got like less than 3 mg/kg of ketamine. In the Hadari paper, it was like 4 mg/kg ketamine. So this is actually a really good effort. I think that's important because nothing is more disappointing than a trial that failed to work. And then you find out that's because it was subtherapeutic dosing. So I think that's really important, right? As you raise the dose, the potential for adverse effects, adverse events goes up. So looking at this, really, it's really not bad. When you compare the Haldol midazolam to ketamine arms, essentially the frequency of adverse events, well, there was some in both. We had 5% of the events in had 5% of administrations in the Haldol midaz arm had a serious adverse event versus 12.5% in the ketamine. But these are really small, 2 out of 40, 5 out of 40. And generally, you know, what, 2 of them go away because of it's just a little bit of supplemental oxygen, which is really something that we can control. I think that overall, these are both pretty well tolerated.
Yeah. And again, one thing that reading this trial that I had to remind myself of is it was stopped early. And so we don't know anytime, you know, you see a trial stopped early, it's not like they stopped it early because ketamine was so great or they stopped it early for, you know, ketamine causing harm. It naturally stopped early, but we're always critical whenever a trial stopped early of would regression to the mean happen? So maybe those numbers, they would have come back down in the ketamine arm, gone up in the midazolam, haloperidol arm, and sort of evened out. Or is this a signal, really, ketamine, there would have been more adverse events if it had been continued out? And we don't know. In any trial this small, you're not going to really see, or it's not going to really be powered to pick up what maybe some of those rare but really important events. So I think that ketamine is a serious agent and we got to take it seriously. So it's what I reach for when we really got to get control right now because it's dangerous. But it's something I take seriously too.
I like that last figure before we move on, where they have this sort of heat map where each arm had 40 patients, and they sort of put on the graph like how long it took that to be. They basically had 40 agitated patients in each wing, in each arm of the trial, and how long did it take for things to get better? And in the ketamine arm, really, you basically had 3/4 of your patients appropriately dealt with, appropriately treated within 10 minutes, dropped to 10 patients out of 40. Whereas in the Haldol midaz, it actually took 30 minutes to reach that point. And basically by then, ketamine is actually kind of wearing off a little tiny bit. But if you look at it carefully, where ketamine gets to when it's wearing off is literally where midaz and Haldol is finally getting at 30 minutes. So this to me is, again, practice changing. I've got a little bit of hassle bias against using amketamine because it's just not what my particular emergency department does. But now I'm thinking I probably should push for this because that's a huge difference.
Yeah, I think they optimized the comparator group here by using the midazolam instead of lorazepam, which works a little more quickly. Midazolam tends to work more quickly than lorazepam. And that's something that I sort of learned and changed my practice on as reading the studies is that, yeah, midazolam does work more quickly. And I don't know why I'd used lorazepam. It's just what we had always used. And so I actually switched. And so here I like that the comparator was at least something that had a chance of moving the needle more quickly. And this sort of gets to the other point that I wanted to emphasize in this podcast, which is where I sort of made that practice change, is that the onset of midazolam when given intramuscularly is quicker than lorazepam. And this came across my radar recently. You know, we've got this length of stay problem in boarding and capacity problems in the emergency department these days. So anytime I can move a patient, I get really excited about that. And when we get these medications, often then we have to sit on these patients for quite some time, whether till they metabolize whatever substance sort of provoked this agitation, until they can, you know, they are aware enough till their medical problem is sort of like figured out, or whatever. And there was a study, it was just a little research letter in Academic Emergency Medicine. But basically what they said was they were like, this is Conrarity et al. And they implemented midazolam and haloperidol because they said January 2019, midazolam works more quickly. So we're going to start using this. And then they went back and they did this retrospective study. And they're like, it also wears off more quickly. I wonder, does it have any association with length of stay? And this is sort of understanding like lots of things can confound length of stay. So Jeremy, what did they find?
So they did find that, and it's 5 and 5 of haloperidol midaz, is that right? And it's 5 and 2 of haloperidol lorazepam, but that's fine. That's an appropriate comparison. And what they found was there was a difference in the adjusted emergency department length of stay. And the difference was, on one hand, for the haloperidol and midazolam, you had 1,027 minutes, which was lower than what you found for the haloperidol lorazepam of 1,169 minutes. Okay, that's not, those are long stays, by the way. These are clearly a lot of patients who are in psychiatric holds and that sort of thing. And you would think, wow, this isn't like the longest difference in the universe. But what I would say is, if you think about how many patients you have in the department at a time, the difference of 100 minutes a couple times a week, when you think about the days of patient bed openness or patient nurse time or doctor time, whatever it is, that over several months, let alone a year, is actually huge. So it's one of those situations where, like, yeah, when you look at 1,000 versus 1,100 hours, it doesn't seem like a big difference. But on the system, it actually is a huge difference.
Because I'm imagining that per shift, there are, you know, maybe not on day shift quite as much, but I'm a nocturnist. We get lots of this at night. So I may have, you know, between 2 and 4 people that sort of fit this scenario. And so that adds up to a couple hours. Yeah. And I think one other point here is we've kind of talked like ketamine when we really need to get that control and then sort of our default backup. But Jeremy, are there times in which you go to certain medications for things? So for example, if I have a patient who has alcohol intoxication and they're really belligerent, unsafe, they've also had trauma, and so you need to get them to the CT scanner, I will often go for like droperidol first and hold on the benzo because they already sort of have that benzo-esque thing on board, and maybe I can buy some time because I don't want to like snow them and then have them withdraw on the other end. I don't know. So often in the alcohol intoxicated patient, I will preferentially maybe hold on the benzo versus other times I may lead with a benzo, like if they have some sort of sympathomimetic on board, I might like really sort of lean into some benzo as well.
Yeah, that's a great point. I actually think that I've been a little too like excited about droperidol monotherapy at times. And I've had situations where I should have added the second agent sooner, or maybe, as you say, like swap in, think, okay, wait a second, I've got a sympathomimetic surge. If I thought this was some sort of toxidrome, the mainstay in therapy would be a benzodiazepine. So I think that I'm guilty of like droperidol love affair. And over time though, I'm realizing that it's a great drug. I've seen it do exactly what I was told it would do, which is to help patients get safer quicker. But I've also seen times where I waited a little bit too long because I was like, go, magic droperidol, do your thing. No, I'm not going to rescue yet because I know this drug will work perfectly by itself. And I've been burned by that. So I think that I've learned to love droperidol, and I've also learned to understand its limitations. So sometimes if I just give droperidol, I feel, well, maybe I'm avoiding giving two therapies that someone's going to question later.
You know, I typically go for droperidol and midazolam, or sometimes haloperidol and midazolam. I typically go for the combo. And if I have significant concern for one thing or the other, maybe I think that they need a lot of benzo, like you, I will front load that. Or if I think they're alcohol intoxicated, I might withhold. But most of the time I'm like, I got to sort this out. I'm not sure. Is this medically driven? Is this just they're intoxicated? The other interesting thing is, I don't know if you saw that study. It was by Cole et al. They're out of Hennepin. They do a ton of this agitation research. And they sort of looked at drug shortages at different times with olanzapine and droperidol, which I thought was fascinating. And it didn't get a lot of like coverage on Twitter and stuff, I think because they showed essentially no major difference in like the time to sedation between the olanzapine and the droperidol, which I found interesting. And again, this is sort of why I use a benzo with my droperidol is because I think droperidol is probably pretty similar to haloperidol. But I thought that was interesting that there wasn't a big difference. Sort of, it wasn't a randomized trial. It was prospective. And they sort of like is quasi-experimental because they have these natural like drug shortages and you could see where they spiked their use. But I thought that was interesting. And I thought I wanted to do this on a podcast because it's a place where my when I encounter literature that makes me change my practice, I want to still be open to that rather than like, I've always done 5-2. I'm going to keep doing it that way. Or like, what is this ketamine? How do I give it? What doses are appropriate? So,
yeah. And I'm really, to really wrap this all up, I'm really thinking about cases I've had recently and thinking that probably the mistake I is too much reliance or waiting too long for that droperidol to work and not going with ketamine. Because it works so well. Nothing's perfect, but I really am convinced that for so many patients that the IM ketamine is probably a much better approach than maybe the one I've been using.
Excellent. Well, this wraps it up for this episode of Phonecast. Jeremy, so good to have you on your own podcast. Thank you for coming.
I still do enjoy practicing emergency medicine. And my residents ask me these questions. And lately, I find myself saying, I haven't done enough lit review on this. That's not a place I want to be. So I want to be here on Phonecast where we keep up with stuff.
All right. Everything can be found on phonecast.org or on Twitter at foampodcast.
Thanks for listening and remembering not to foam it alone.
Phonecast is free open access medical education. The opinions expressed are ours alone and no one else's.
Bye.